House Judiciary Committee, today is March 15th, 2017. First item on the agenda we're going to go to today is House Bill 2846.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2846 was brought to us by Representative Evans. House Bill 2846 allows law enforcement units to sponsor reserve officers for training as a police officer. It also allows for these reserve officers to pay for this training with cash and GI Bill benefits, directs the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to increase class size by up to 25% as needed to train these officers. Finally, it requires that these officers remain with the law enforcement unit that sponsored them for 3 years, and the program would sunset on January 2nd, 2024. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact. We did get in today that there is a fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem, one of the prettiest districts in the state. I always get in trouble when I say it's the prettiest. See, I noticed, I learned. The goal today really is to bring forward a bill that I have actually brought before you before, but the goal is still the same, and hopefully, given our current circumstances for looking at alternative revenues, it may actually be a third time is the charm. House Bill 2846 really seeks to do two things. Number one, it seeks to learn from the lessons that have been demonstrated at universities throughout Oregon that out-of-state money, non-state money, is actually helpful to sustain programs. The second is to make sure that folks that have a GI Bill and a desire to serve in the public can actually take advantage of that a little more perhaps swiftly than currently the case. And the third, and I would say added bonus, is for reserve forces, for sheriffs and police chiefs to potentially actually have a more trained cadre from which to serve. So let me explain the basics of the bill. Right now, I'm going to channel my former mayor role. When I was mayor of Monmouth, I knew that if we hired two police officers, being so close to Salem, over the course of 3 years, it would be very likely that after we paid for both officers to go to DPSST, they got back from DPSST, they got trained, they got the ability to be by themselves and serve. By the end of that three-year mark, we would be losing at least one of them to Corvallis, to Salem, to some other place, because Monmouth never could pay as much as other places. Right now, small cities, and I assume counties, pay the salary while someone attends DPSST, and then the state allocates money for DPSST for the assigned training. If we had this bill in place, how it could work is a person with a GI Bill, a veteran coming out with a desire to serve as a police officer someday full-time, could commit with a sheriff or a police chief. If they're sponsored by the police chief or the sheriff, and again, that's the key critical difference, if they're sponsored, they would be able to attend a class that's DPSST puts on, and the state could charge whatever fee we thought was fair, because the GI Bill will pay the highest state tuition for a program leading to a job. So it'll pay for college, it'll pay for aviation school, it'll pay for all kinds of things. In this particular context, where the state doesn't have many state police academies or public service academies, we could set our own rate. Theoretically, we could set a rate like we do out-of-state tuition that's slightly higher than the actual cost to make sure that it helps with the sustainability of the program overall. If this was in place, sponsored folks would go through the training. They'd go back to the sponsor and serve for a minimum time. Again, that could be negotiated, but right now it says three. If they're hired somewhere, obviously that can be the 3 years could go away. But what would happen is they'd then, of course, be under the leadership of another sworn senior officer. Several years ago, when this was a concept being talked about, the biggest concern I heard from police chiefs was they did not want highly trained folks causing havoc out there that weren't connected to a department. I absolutely get that. On the other hand, we have a lot of veterans with equally high training and different types of skills that want to serve. And in this particular case, if they are under the sponsor, whether in a reserve status or perhaps after getting road time and getting the opportunity to practice their skills, it may actually give them a leg up when they're trying to hire on to a permanent position. The best part of this is it would actually take away the cost of the cities that have sometimes become training grounds, because they wouldn't have to pay while the person is at DPSST. They're a reserve officer. The GI Bill would pay for that. They wouldn't actually have to pay when the reserve officer got back. You could actually put a period of time associated with the field or jurisdictional training that's necessary after DPSST until you get signed off. We could design this however we wanted. So this bill is designed to try to provide access to another revenue stream, and it's designed to get vets who want to continue serving the public in some form or fashion a leg up and an opportunity to serve.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Springer.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill, Representative. So I'm one of those that have had a couple concerns about the bill.
Mm-hmm. So does DPSST.
So one of those concerns would be, I like the fact, I think this is a change from last time, that you have to be a reserve police officer. I like that piece. But not all departments put their reserves, or if any, put their reserves through psychological testing.
Mm-hmm.
So we still have that element unknown, and we don't know if somebody is appropriate for police work ultimately or not. Do you have a response to that?
Chair Barker, I actually do. The goal of the program is, as it's set up, DPSST can actually put whatever qualifications they want on the department on the front side. So before a person is sponsored, certain requirements have to be met. And the best part is the GI Bill would actually pay for that process. Whatever is a part of the formal network that can be actually scoped out and explained as the step-by-step training program can be reimbursed. So I absolutely think that the psychological training, the health training, whatever medical exams need to be done for the physical side as well, probably background, character reference, all that stuff can be actually charged as a part of the program and reimbursed through the GI Bill.
Okay. Follow up,
Mr. Please.
Chair. Thank you. Whole bunch of years ago when I went to the police academy, mm-hmm. I had to wait a long time.
Yes.
And I worked the road a long time before I went to the police academy for a whole 8 weeks. There has never, to my knowledge, been an idea or a philosophy that there are extra spaces mm-hmm. at the police academy. I know you're not DPST, so this is not a totally fair question to you. But I would hate to see an officer that is sworn and working for a department be bumped by somebody that wants to try this out.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I absolutely understand the concern. Two pieces that at least help me on that. First is we could... Again, as setting up the pilot program, we could wait until there were enough of these to run a particular class of just those folks that are in that particular status. The other piece of that is that the whole idea of the GI Bill is to be able to charge more than what it costs the state. So we would actually be adding capacity every one we ran through, as opposed to the cost right now that we do not have access to those revenues. I mean, when we put people through right now, it's all in the state or the city. By leveraging the GI Bill, we can charge more than the cost of the actual cost for the state, and actually theoretically add capacity over time. In other disciplines, EMS, fire, it's very common that people have to pay for their own training or do different aspects of pay, sometimes reimbursed. This is not a perfect plan, but it is an access to right now a revenue stream we are denying ourselves.
Fair enough. Well, another one?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume this is still the same, but part of becoming a police officer is getting a DPSST number. I guess it is at a BPSD number. That tells you something sad. And I remember it because it was everything.
Mm-hmm.
That BPSD number of mine, 19803, was the key to everything. Mm-hmm. And it gave me access to things.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to have a number in the academy. And without being, I would assume, because your DPSST number, I'm assuming it's that same way, we could be giving people a key that are not full-fledged professional police officers. I don't think that's really even a fair question to you. I wish the Academy was here to address that. The Academy is here to address that.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer,
you come on up.
Whatever people were sponsored by a sheriff or a chief, I would imagine they would use the same disciplinary approach that they would for full-time or reserves that did something with that number they shouldn't have. I mean, to me, if you're sworn, if you take an oath to the state to be a peace officer and you violate that, whatever status, you're still subject to the rules, I would imagine.
Committee members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Hale. I oversee the professional standards division of DPSST, so the regulatory side of the shop. We did submit some written testimony on this bill, sharing some concerns that we would have with it. I wasn't necessarily prepared to provide any verbal testimony, but would be happy to have any operational questions that you would have about how DPSST works.
I'm sorry, I have to qualify why I just chuckled. Chair Barker just sent me his DPSST number. It's incredibly sad.
Is it a two-digit
number? Let's just say it's two digits.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I mean, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, mine starts 10246. Just if we're in competition, I mean, I know Andy has probably got like two.
Just leave me alone.
I think they want your question.
They do. Okay. So one question that I have is, how would this work for people? Because it seems to me we'd be opening a door, right? And so how would this work for people who weren't veterans but were reserves or wanted to be reserves? Because traditionally reserves, like I got trained as a reserve in the Multnomah County Academy, mm-hmm. not sent to DPSST. So do we know how this would work for non-veterans?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, we know how it would work because we would be setting the pilot program up however we wanted it to work.
Okay.
And again, there are some states where it's pay to play. Right. There are some states like ours that are not.
Right.
The GI Bill, again, offers a unique, hypothetically, if a state was in, I don't know, financial straits and looking for revenues, it offers, in my mind, an opportunity to do those things of, A, connecting somebody who, if they have an honorable discharge, at least have proven themselves not to be a threat to the country. And the second piece, is access to funds that are supposed to be used for follow-on professional training. I know that several of the folks up here are actually both veterans and former peace officers. As far as the idea of giving reserve officers too much training, I know that on the fire side, most full-time fire folks, at least used to, start out as volunteers and continue their training. In this case, by having, again, at least what's in the bill, if not more, through rule, a partnership between a sponsor and a potential person who takes advantage of this training, you're giving somebody an opportunity to get advanced training and an opportunity to practice the craft so that they could potentially be hired. I mean, I don't think many people would take advantage of this that weren't thinking that they wanted to be a peace officer. Now, again, I don't know what it is for police, but I know teachers after 5 years, one out of every three or four are no longer doing it. I can't speak to that. What I can say is we've got a lot of folks that are coming back with a whole lot of skills and training in certain aspects that sometimes align with law enforcement. We have money that could be used. We could set our own price. And again, if it's under the sponsorship of somebody who is a senior police officer, I trust them to send people that are worthy of the program.
One quick follow-up. So I get all of that. I mean, and it makes sense to me. I'm just worried that we might get into a situation where we would say, well, if you were a veteran, you could have access to this, but if you had not been a veteran, then you wouldn't have access to it, and I think that could cause some problems.
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I think I'm sure it could.
Yeah.
The question would be, again, under the auspices of a pilot program, I think under pilot programs, you were generally given a little more ability to be selective in what groups you try, and if it comes out that it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. If it comes out that it works, there may be an opening for a different approach. I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. You could probably answer this question, and maybe this isn't the same issue it used to be a few years ago. What's the wait list?
Right now, we are registering fully employed police officers in July's class. So we're running, this biennium, we're running 18 classes as opposed to 15, the previous biennium. So we're seeing an increase, and you're right. There is always that lag between when an officer is hired between when they can get into the academy. And what we do there is create an issue for the employing agency on what do they do with that person prior to them getting trained. What some agencies have done is altered their hiring practices to hire the person the day they go to the academy. But we are seeing that lag. And a lot of that lag is the fact that there is quite a significant hiring boom due to all the vacancies from retirements and such. Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. On our people are going through the academy, can they qualify for the GI Bill?
We work with the Veterans Affairs Department to ensure that folks who are coming to DPSST who are employed police officers get their GI benefits as on-the-job training.
Right.
So we don't qualify as a recognized VA approved educational program. Forgive me, I'm not familiar with the vernacular, but we do work with the veterans to make sure that they get what their benefit affords them. And I think, and I included in my testimony, we're looking at approximately 35% of the people coming through the academy are have previously served in the armed forces.
It's back in 1970, when I was in the State Police Academy, they said, oh, that's on the job training, and I got a check for I don't remember how much.
Can I do one quick? Okay. One thing that I was just thinking of when you were asking your question is why couldn't you do this program but do it through the individual counties that do reserve training? Because there's a cost there.
Sure.
And that would take pressure off of DPSST.
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I can't speak for DPSST. I know she's going to, but for the GI Bill side, the Reserve Academy doesn't lead to a full-time job.
Okay.
The certification that they will pay for has to be linked to training to a professional job.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Chair Barker, if I may, right now DPSST doesn't train or certify reserve officers. And I think that's where the disconnect is. So the only requirement of reserve officers right now is that a background check be done that is similar to that would be done of a full-time officer. The board doesn't have any additional standards. So we don't have any reserve officers attending the academy right now.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2846 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2611.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Current law allows for certain government agencies to obtain reimbursement when an employee leaves that agency for a subsequent agency within a certain time period and the original agency has invested training costs into that employee. House Bill 2611 modifies this law to provide the same repayment schedule for law enforcement agencies employing correction and police officers. It also requires the original agency to request reimbursement in writing within 6 months. It also limits the applicable expenses subject to this reimbursement and eliminates the requirement to reimburse employers for parole and probation officers. There is no amendment, there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Call Chief Kearns and Kevin Campbell, please.
Bill feels bad now that we have numbers and he doesn't.
Special class.
Chair Barker and representatives, I'm Pete Kearns. I'm the Eugene Police Chief, and I'm here representing both the City of Eugene and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. So the story behind our presence here kind of begins when agencies started implementing the original law, and a number of us received bills as we hired people from other agencies. And what's great about law enforcement in Oregon is the level of coordination, cooperation that we extend to one another. And the language in the original law was confusing, and so the level of payment that was expected in order to reimburse agencies from whom we would hire officers was confusing, and it led to some disagreements that were difficult to work through with the language as it stood. So members of OACP and OSSA gathered together, and over the course of a handful of meetings together with DPSST staff, we came up with language that we recommend as revisions that help to clarify what is qualifying training time and how to go about reimbursements.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I'll go into a little more detail about the actual provisions of the bill. The original law was passed in 2009. It was a law that was sponsored by Senator Joanne Verger. Some of you served with her. She was concerned from the South Coast. She had an agency where you can imagine if you hired an officer and then had them go through the 16 weeks of basic training. And then, of course, there's a field training period that can last 16 weeks as well. You can get through all of that period having paid for salary and benefits. And if you lose that officer to another agency that hires them away, the other agency gets the benefit of the officer without the cost. And so in 2009, Senator Verger says, you know, we need a law that provides a method for reimbursing. And as Chief Kearns has mentioned, the challenge was ambiguity in the statute. And any ambiguity, of course, creates conflict. Some people were charging for the salary and benefits and then for a backfilled position that wouldn't have been there anyway. And it just created the kind of conflict that we don't need between agencies. And so the work group that Chief Kearns led had a wide range of agencies, large and small, from throughout the state. So the good news is the bill before you is designed to create that clarity, and it does the following few things. First of all, it clarifies what qualifies as an expense. So it really limits it to salary and benefits during that basic training period or that field training period, which I mentioned is 16 weeks for police. It's 6 weeks for corrections. And so that clarifies that's what qualifies for expense. At the request of the community corrections directors, parole and probation, which is not an issue at all, asked to be just removed from the provisions of the law, which is also done in this bill. It clarifies for purposes of reimbursement that it's the date of hire that is the operative date for calculating reimbursement, which was unclear originally. And it specifies that request for reimbursement has to be made within 6 months of the time that the officer is hired away by another agency. So this continues to keep key provisions that were originally in the 2009 bill in place. It doesn't change the fact that for an agency can choose not to seek reimbursement. It doesn't require them to. There's reasons why they might not. But we think this is a good bill. It makes it clearer, and I think that in the long run it'll create less conflict potentially between agencies that are already a little frustrated when they lose a well-trained officer to another agency, which is the reality of the world we live in. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we appreciate your time today to consider this bill.
Anybody have any questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. On page one of the bill, lines 19 through 24, which is really the heart of the bill, it talks about covering qualifying expenses, means the actual amount of salary and benefits paid by a law enforcement unit to a corrections or police officer while that corrections or police officer was A, engaged in basic training. Is that the academy?
Yes, it is.
Okay. B, completing 6 weeks for corrections. C, completing up to 16 weeks of police officer field training. Now, 16 weeks, the reason that's confusing me is also the time of the academy. So we're talking field training officer time on the streets, and that's 16 weeks?
It's up to 16 weeks. For some agencies, it's less.
Okay. Okay. May I briefly follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was one of those people that agencies didn't like because I got hired, and I remember I was applying at big, like LA and NYPD and Dallas, Texas and Seattle, big departments. And I had a puny little county hire me, and I've always said they hired me because I had my own gun and they didn't have any money. And I went over there, and I remember the week I was hired, I said to some friends, I will be in and out of here so fast, they won't remember my name, but I will be sent to the academy. And that is not an exclusive attitude of young police officers. That 21 at the time, I just want my certificate. That's all I want, and then I want to go where I want to go. I was there 16 months, not a long time. I got my piece of paper. I fell in love with the place. I really didn't want to go. But the reality is that was a devastating cost to a department, and maybe it's a joke they hired me because I have my own gun, but when I went and asked for a vest that was $350, ballistics vest at the time, $350, they said, we don't do those because we only have $250 mm-hmm. for uniforms. So that is a crucial problem, a big problem for small agencies. And it's the Eugenes of the world that pick those people up. Mm-hmm.
Chair Barker, the guilty party, sitting next to me.
There we go. I thought he had a shifty look about him.
Wow.
No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Wow. Close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2611.
So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2611 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2611 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry the bill.
Are you sure? I'll take it.
I'll take it.
Everybody will take it.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, you have a good example. So, Representative Springer will be the carrier.
There you go.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2618.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2618 increases fees collected by sheriffs in civil proceedings. It also directs the state court administrator to calculate cost of living increases and adjust these fees based on that calculation. There's also a dash one amendment. This amendment removes the provision requiring the state court administrator to calculate cost of living increases and then adjust the fees. There is a minimal revenue impact and there is no fiscal impact.
Okay, Sheriff Myers and Bruce Miller, please.
Chair Barkers, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to support House Bill 2618 with the adoption of the Dash 1 Amendment. Oregon County Sheriffs perform a wide variety of public safety services beyond just traditional policing, corrections, and community corrections. This includes the serving of summons, subpoenas, citations, orders, and notices for a wide range of civil actions, suits, and proceedings where a fee is charged. The purpose of House Bill 2618 is to seek an increase in these fees to address the increased cost to sheriff's offices for performing these responsibilities. Currently, there is no provision in statute for increasing these fees based on cost of living. And the last time we approached the legislature to adjust these fees was in 2009. At that time, we testified to actual cost for serving a document. By the second attempt was anywhere from $70 to $80, so our request today is not designed to recover the actual costs. By comparison, surrounding states in 2009 charged between $35 and $45 for service per person, but unlike Oregon, they also charge for a return of service fees, mileage, and there is no limit to that, and notary fees. By statute, we do not charge these extra fees. In House Bill 2618 as written, we included a provision that would allow these fees to be increased based on a cost of living over time. The bill currently tasks the state court administrator's office with the responsibility for calculating any increase based on the Portland-Salem, Oregon-Washington Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers and all items as published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the United States Department of Labor. Now that's a mouthful. Well, we would like to explore the possibility of a more regular way to revisit and adjust these fees. It is clear that the state court administrator's office is not the appropriate entity to make this calculation. As a result, we requested a Dash 1 amendment that removes the COLA increase provision altogether. We thank you for your consideration and ask that you support 2618 with the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the state court administrator. While we had some concerns with the bill as originally drafted, the Dash 1 amendments take care of our concerns. I'd like to thank Sheriff Myers and Kevin Campbell and the Sheriff's Association for not only being willing to discuss our concerns, but also to go to the effort to have the Draft 1 amendment adopted or drafted for your consideration. We respectfully request that you support the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to testify? Okay.
I'm good, Chair Parker.
Questions? Representative Vile.
Chair Parker, anybody can answer this. I was kind of fascinated by the idea of leaving a COLA in as well so that we don't have to keep coming back and revisiting this issue all the time. I'm curious as to what the perceived problem is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, from our perspective, it's not appropriate for the judicial branch to be setting and adjusting fees for executive branch entities. It's not part of our core work, and it would certainly add workload to the state court administrator when we have other judicial department activities that we need to address.
Follow up. So the idea that you'd have to track that COLA and adjust fees from time to time being additional workload was the concern?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vile, that and us being the inappropriate branch for this, certainly the legislature and the executive branch have offices that are well equipped to make these calculations. We tend to view fees as a legislative function and not a court function.
Follow up, please. If it's simply a matter of applying, we've got $10 today, and we know what the COLA is because it's published. If it's simply a matter of just a formula, is the department in that case actually really setting the fee, or is it just acting on a fee that's already set, subject to a reset with it's a formula rather than a specific fee is what it amounts to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vile, it is changing the fee, and I've watched over the years the legislature gets very interested when fees are changed, and they want to have their hand in that. The other issue is this addresses four or five fees in one statute. Now, that doesn't seem like very much, but when you consider the number of fees that are set in statute, as soon as you set this precedent, then you're shoving a fair amount of workload over the state court administrator's office. And it's not a matter of simply adjusting the fee. The CPI number for the previous year comes out usually at the end of February. You need to get that number. You need to apply it to whatever number of fees that you're going to adjust. We think best practice is then to send it out for public comment because the public should know when something is being adjusted and be able to comment on it and see if your adjustment is correct. We would have an outside entity double check our math. It's fairly simple and it's easy to check, but we would do that. Then we would finalize the fee, and then you have to somehow publicize the fee change. So there's a little more into it than just simply changing a number.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support this bill for sure, but I have to confess that I'm a bit puzzled by the reluctance of the state court administrator to do what I think is a pretty simple process, and I'm not sure it would require notice to the public if we statutorily set a process and formula. So, but I will be supporting this bill.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Close the book. Okay, don't close the book. Any more comment here?
Okay, I think we have to adopt the Dash 1s.
Matt Klein, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. I appreciate your allowing me to testify at this time.
You need to say your name for the record. So.
Matt Klein.
Thank you.
And I am a civil process server. My company is out of Springfield, Oregon, and we support this bill on two sides. Number one, by raising the sheriff's rates, it allows the civil process servers to raise their rates too, even though in one portion of the statutes it states that civil process servers can raise their rates to whatever their clients agree upon. There's another statute that says the court will only award the prevailing party the amount the sheriff can get. So for that reason, we have kind of a glass window that, or ceiling that we are stuck at by many of our clients. The other side is as a taxpayer in Oregon. As was testified just now, the actual cost of a service by the sheriff's department is upwards of $70 to $80, whereas the only fee they can recover from the litigants is the, if it goes to 45, would be 45. So the difference there is now a burden on taxpayers. And for the taxpayers to subsidize litigants in lawsuits seems that it's a little bit unfair. And so for that reason, I also support the increase in the fees.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Klein, for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the
clarity
committee.
Clarity to us about this whole thing.
What's that?
Bring some clarity.
That is unlikely, as you can tell just by looking at me. No, but Chair Barker, members of the committee, I did want to mention that to Representative Vile's point, I appreciate your consideration. I think we'd like Kevin Campbell.
Yeah, thank you.
Chiefs and Sheriffs Associations, thank you. And we would like to do that. We did find that the State Court Administrator's Office probably wasn't the best place to place that. And frankly, we're still working to try to figure out who is, and we would definitely consider bringing an amendment to do that. If it is the committee's wish to do it, we would love to pursue it. But we kind of identified them, as you know, without talking to them, which is unfair. And there are other folks that are probably more appropriate to do that in this case. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that I clarified that.
Okay, thank you. It's my intention to move. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I would be a lot more comfortable if we did have a bill that allowed for some formula to increase without having to keep coming back to the legislature every time we need another 10 bucks on this thing. The other thing I would say is that, at least from my perspective, the gap between the private market and the sheriff's cost seems to be a little bit artificial, and I'm not sure why we have that. If we're not recovering actual costs by the publicly financed agency, that seems to be kind of upside down to me. And so I would urge you to reconsider that part of it as well.
Thank you. And it's my intention to move this bill, and maybe this is one which I hate to take the chance, but might be able to be straightened out another, well, I guess this side of the building.
Chair Barker, that's fine. We'd be glad to pursue an amendment on the Senate side.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing, open a work session, House Bill 2618. We have an amendment, so when you want to refresh the amendment, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, actually I move dash one amendments into House Bill 2618.
Representative also moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2618. We've discussed those. Anybody need further clarification on the amendment? Okay. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2618 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2618 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, so ordered. Representative Olson, will you carry that
first,
please? Thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 2113.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. We previously heard about House Bill 2113 on February 20th, and it was brought to us by Representative Greenlick. If you recall, House Bill 2113 allows secular organizations or a celebrant or officiant of a secular organization to solemnize marriages. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Is there any discussion? Are there any?
There's no motion.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2113 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson. Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2113 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, could you do a roll call vote?
We will do a roll call vote.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Forsyth?
Yes.
Representative Greenlick?
Yes.
You can't guess.
Representative Blanger?
Yes.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Sanchez?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
No.
Representative Stark?
Excused.
Representative Vile?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Yes. Motion carries. I'm going to ask Representative Greenlick to be the carrier, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, committee. And thank you, committee. We stand adjourned.
Thank you, Rich.
Committee, we stand adjourned.